Well, I am delighted to welcome Roger Lear back to this radio program. Dr. Roger Lear has appeared on this program over the years many, many times. He's appeared on Coast to Coast AM, where Art Bell commented, Roger Lear did 4 hours, the most riveting radio ever broadcast on open national airwaves. And you're going to be in for a treat again today, because Roger Lear has got some extraordinary things to say to you. Now, many, many of you find it, and we hear this in email every time Roger comes on the air, difficult to listen to Roger Lear because it is so frightening to think about his subject, implants. Well, it's frightening for me too, because as most of you know, I have one in my ear that cannot be removed, or I dare not remove it because of what happened when that was attempted some years ago. However, that said, I am a completely independent, normally functioning human being. I am not a robot. I am not in any health problems because of this. And, Roger, let me ask you this. Now, I would say that Dr. Roger Lear needs no introduction, but I will. Before I ask you the question, Roger, I am going to introduce you a little bit. Dr. Lear is a true pioneer. He went to a UFO convention and saw somebody talking about implants and decided as a scientist and MD, a doctor, which he is, that he would see if there was any scientific basis for this. He proceeded from there to here. He went into it. He was the first person to detect the presence of an implant in somebody who said that they had had a close encounter experience and had been implanted. I had tried this before using MRI scans and had failed because we were looking in the wrong place. We were looking in people's brains when we probably should have been looking where Roger looked, in their feet and hands and so forth. Now, this said, you're talking to and listening to today a true pioneer in the UFO field. Dr. Lear has suffered almost a martyrdom in his professional life because of it, just like John Mack did. God love him. God rest his soul. And it's hard. But this is an important man. He's unique in this world. In fact, Jordan Maxwell, who is quite a famous lecturer, author, and you've heard him on this radio program, says, of all the stories I've heard over the past 40 years in dealing with the UFO phenomenon and the paranormal, I am of the opinion the single most important story is that of Dr. Roger Lear. So, Roger, welcome to the program.
Well, it's good to be with you once again, Wendley.
Well, indeed, and I'm afraid my introduction was a little long-winded, but that's okay. You deserve it, because you have done such a service for mankind at such personal cost, and you're scorned and derided by the general media, pretty much, whenever they notice you. People in your own profession steer clear of you. The scientific community will have nothing to do with you. And above all, there's no funding for this research. But let me do this, Roger. I want to begin with the people you have dealt with. I want to know something about what people who have these things in their bodies are like, what kind of stories they tell. Let us know. When you first got into this, what were the people that you met? How did they strike you?
Well, the first two individuals that I got involved with surgically, a gentleman and a lady, one would be an object that appeared on X-ray in the back of his hand, and another lady with objects in the big toe of the left foot. They seemed, normal, run-of-the-mill, everyday people, very down-to-earth. The gentleman who had the object in the back of his hand used to take the time to amuse and amaze himself and others by using a little stud finder and moving it over the back of his hand and watching the little magnetic needle and the stud finder wiggle back and forth. So, but both of these people had the history that we've come to know in the abduction, alien abduction phenomena that are common. One of the stories that I wrote in the book, The Aliens and the Scalpel, involving the first lady, the first person we removed the two objects from, was very interesting. She was had an experience out on a camping trip in Texas with her husband and with her two children. And they drove some miles out in the country and went to an area where there was kind of a battleground during the Civil War and Civil War days. And it was isolated and desolate, but with a nice little river stream going by so they could camp nearby and do fishing. They set up a camp just on the other side of a wrought iron bridge. And they made ready the camp and went to bed that night. The next day they went out and, did some digging and hiking and fishing and so on, and were having a good time. And as the parents were preparing for dinner and it started to get dark, the two little kids were sitting on a log, and they had managed to get a couple of flashlights. And they were flashing the light up into the sky. And so the mother came over and said, "Gee, what are you guys doing?" "He said, well, we're having fun, Mom. We're just flashing these lights up into the sky and getting answers back." And she says, "What?" And he said, "Oh, yeah, see those lights up there? Well, we flash our flashlights, and they flash back with the same number of flashes." And she said, "Oh, my." And she called the husband over, and he took a look, and he says, "Well, that's probably, some of those military helicopter guys, and they're having fun with us." And they both picked up flashlights and flashed, too. And after that session, while they went and had dinner and went to bed, well, about 3 o'clock in the morning, the husband suddenly comes to the tent and wakes everybody up. Now, they wanted to get up real early the following morning, so he had made a fire, which was going to last all night long. He suddenly woke everybody up. His attitude was totally bizarre, gruff, woke the wife up, told her to quickly get the children and put them in the car. And don't ask questions, just do as I say, which was not like him at all. And she responded, of course, with questions. He said, "Just please get the kids up, put them in the car." And he was terrified. And they ran to the car, and they started heading back home, crossing this wrought iron bridge. And in doing so, the husband saw a light behind them and asked the wife to turn around and see if that was some kind of a large truck. And she says, "Yes, that's what I think it is, but it's getting closer." And as the light got closer and stronger and filled the cab of the car with this brilliant light, she said, "Oh, my God," she said, "it's not a truck." And she looked at it, and the size was absolutely enormous, and she knew that it wasn't going to fit on that bridge. They crossed the bridge, and the story comes to an end because time went by unknowingly to them. And the next thing they knew or realized, they were headed in the opposite direction, going back towards the campsite. And they went back, couldn't remember what happened. They went back to the camp. The fire was gone, and they realized that some hours had gone by. And now they were really terrified, didn't understand, and started heading home with lights following them from time to time. Well, this was only one of the experiences that this individual had, and it was quite an experience, and listening to her tell the story. Now, you have to remember, we have these patients examined both psychologically and physiologically. She fell well within the psychological norm. And the story that the second individual told was almost as good, but a little bit different.
If you're not an unknowncountry.com subscriber, you're missing out big time. You would be amazed at what a subscription brings you. every week something new that is not in free dreamland, pushing 100 special interviews from extraordinary things like the amazing Karina Sable's Close Encounter Experience interview, my life reading where my mother's spirit was contacted by the medium, on and on it goes, extraordinary information, the unforgettable colloquy between William Henry and Lawrence Gardner about white powder gold. There is so much in there, you cannot believe it. Plus all of my hypnosis sessions, plus all of the key discussions, plus the meditations, plus 6 months of downloadable dreamland and 6 months of mysterious powers. It's unbeatable. $11.95 gets you started with a 3-month recurring subscription. Click on that subscribe tab right now. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com. We need you, and I can assure you, you need us. Now, Roger, right up front, I don't want to waste any time, and I want people to listen to this, and I know that they don't listen to these shows because I can see when you're on the air, on the program, listenership drops off after about the first 10 minutes, and we're at 10 minutes now, and folks, I want you to keep listening. Do not be afraid of this. You got to look it in the eye. Don't just tune it out because it's too creepy to think about. And Roger, what I want you to do now is to tell us exactly what kind of process a person goes through when they come to you with a possible implant, with a story. What clues you in on to the idea that the person may have may actually have an implant?
Well, the first thing that happens, Lily, is that there's contact. They contact me. And I listen to their story either by email or telephone. And if they think they have an object, I tell them to produce some reasonable evidence that there is an object there. In other words, if they claim to have an object, then I have to see it as part of the scientific study in an X-ray, a CAT scan, or an MRI. If they haven't even had an X-ray done, then they must start by getting one done, and sometimes I'm able to help make suggestions so they can easily accomplish that. Once the X-rays have been taken, they send them to me, and I will look at the X-rays personally, and then if I see something that's suspicious, then it goes to our radiology consultant. They look at it and verify that whatever it is there doesn't belong there. That's the beginning of the courtship. Now, the next thing is we send them a complete package of questions having to do with the things that we've learned about the abduction phenomena. They answer the questions and then send them back to me, and we have a table whereas we can give them a mathematical score on the possibilities that they do fall within the realm of possible abduction. If the score is high, then we contact them again and tell them that if they would like the object removed, we will do it without any charge. And if they're not in California, then they have to make their own way here. Unfortunately, we can't support travel. If they are in California, most of them can easily get to me. But then once they arrive at my office, they undergo an examination, and I look at the area where the object is, and we go over them physically and physiologically. We order lab studies done, and the next thing is that they go to one of our psychologists, and they're evaluated by the standard psychological test to see whether they're in the norm or not.
And in just a few moments, Roger, in just a few moments, we're going to find out, are alien implant or implant people with implants normal psychologically, or is there something about them that's different? This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. We're back talking to Dr. Roger Lear. And, Roger, you said just before the break that people who are found to have these objects, before surgeries are done on them, they are evaluated psychologically. What kind of evaluations do you generally turn up?
Well, the results of the evaluations fit within the paradigm that other researchers have found, John Mack, Bud Hopkins, David Jacobs, and so on. And that is basically these individuals all fall within the psychological norm. Now, the only thing that I have personally found as a significant trait for most of the abduction cases that I've looked at is that these people seem to have creative minds. Maybe whoever is doing this is not looking for Einsteins with high IQs, but it seems, in Southern California, of course, we have a tremendous number of people who are in the entertainment business. Writers and directors and people involved with motion pictures and so on. But, you know, it's true outside of this area, too. A lot of the individuals have creative talents. They can write or perform as musicians, or they can paint, artists, and so on. So that's the only really significant find. Now, my cousin Kenneth Ring, looked at them also when he wrote his book, The Omega Project, and that's what he was looking for.
Now, tell us a little bit about what The Omega Project is, Roger.
Well, The Omega Project involved my cousin, Dr. Kenneth Ring, when he was a professor at University of Connecticut, and it was fully funded by them. It was quite a research project, but his mission in life was to study near-death experiences. And what he thought was, you know, it's kind of interesting. Let's take a look at those individuals who report near-death experiences and those who had UFO experiences and see if we can find a common psychological denominator. And he's a PhD psychologist. And after a very deep, in-depth study, he also found that people who had near-death experiences and people who had UFO experiences were, by and large, all within the psychological norm.
So they're normal people. They're somewhat more creative than the average. Now, let me ask you this. What you always refer to these as alien implants. Why do you call them alien implants, Roger?
Well, for really two practical reasons, really. Number one, they don't belong in the body, so they're alien to the body. So nobody's going to argue with that.
No.
And then the other aspect of it is that when we do the analysis of these objects, some of the things we find include isotopic ratios, which are considered non-terrestrial, stuff that's not from this planet. So obviously, it's alien to the planet and alien to the body, too. So I think you're pretty safe in using the term.
Now, there are things about these objects that are technologically beyond what we can do. I know that, of course. But why don't you tell us exactly what some of these things are?
Well, some of the we've done 11 surgeries to date. I have another one that I'm going to do as soon as we're able to get the funding to do it. Another very interesting case with an object in the foot. But by and large, the majority of the objects which we have removed are metallic objects, and they're covered with this very strange biological coating. Now, as this is like, you know, building a house because you start from somewhere and you just continue to build, so the knowledge builds. Obviously, what we know today is a lot more than what we knew when I started the process. But in looking at the metallic objects, first of all, they're a small piece of metal of varying shapes, usually a small rod, which is covered with a biological coating. And when you look at the microscopic picture of what this looks like, the biological coating is actually anchored into the metal. Now, we've been in various labs where certainly black budget projects are going on, and we find interest by scientists in looking at this because basically it's due to the fact that we don't know how to do these things. We don't know how to anchor biological tissue or have it grow into a piece of metal. Then we look at some of the other aspects of it. Now, we've been able to check for electromagnetic field strength before these are removed. And by and large, again, all of them exhibit some electromagnetic field, some 2 to 6 milligauss, which is a pretty strong field. And the last one that we did, again, you know, we try and learn a little more with each one. We were able to use a radio frequency detector. And we actually put the patient out in a circle, which we had checked way, a long way from any electromagnetic sources, and found that she, most probably the area of where this object was emitting 2 radio frequencies. So does this answer any questions? Are these transmitters? What exactly is going on?
How many objects have you tested for radio frequency emission?
This was the first one.
And it was emitting radio frequencies.
Yes, there was 2 radio frequencies, both in the FM band, and it would lock on one for a while, and then it would change, and it would go to the other one, and then back to the first one, and oscillate back and forth between the two. Now, this is a clue, but it's not an answer, because, you know, what's going on? Can you definitely say that this thing is putting out these radio frequencies? The only answer is no. Because it could be relaying something, either another radio frequency, bouncing off of this thing, and you're getting a harmonic. And I'm sure anybody that's in radio, I don't have to explain this to Art because he is in radio, harmonics are not the original frequency. And then again, how do we know this thing is not being stimulated by some other kind of energy, like high energy particles that go through space? And then it, in turn, generates a radio frequency. So, like many things we found, when you think you have the answers to a question, you really find that you have more questions.
Now, were you able to listen to this at all? Was anyone able to record it, or?
No, that's the next step, and I'd like to do that with the next one. If I can get either a laboratory or the equipment, that would be the next thing to be done, was not only to isolate the frequencies that were coming out, but run it through an oscilloscope so that we can look at a wave and also listen to it and have an audible sound. So,
I regret the loss of Dr. Bill Mallow at a time like this because, of course, he was the researcher at Southwest Research Institute who was so willing to help us, and he had at the Institute an extraordinarily sophisticated signals acquisition lab, which he was able to use. And in fact, one time when I was there, he observed my implant activate, and when it activated, it hasn't in many years, but in those days when it did, it would my ear would get hot and turn bright red, and I would hear a noise, a sort of high-pitched noise, like an old-fashioned modem starting up in my ear. And we went into the signals acquisition lab, and I saw the lab, and it would be the ideal place for you to work. Unfortunately, as the director of Southwest Research told Dr. Mallow, their CIA client, which is like half of their business at Southwest Research, takes a dim view of UFO studies, so we're not welcome there anymore now that this very powerful man has passed away. It's a shame. And do you have any other place you may be able to take people that really has high-quality signals acquisition capabilities?
Well, I have heard, and I have not checked this out, but I'm going to. I heard quite recently that UCLA has such a signal detection laboratory. So I'm going to check there and see if that's possible. Someone in the audience that's listening to the program knows where such a facility is available in Southern California, please contact me through my website.
Well, let's hope that happens, because goodness knows we need it. We have in the loss of Bill Mallow and Jim Fueling and Steve Schiff, Congressman Schiff, we've lost a lot of the more powerful people in our field, people who were really capable of getting things done. And we need someone to definitely to replace them. You know, Roger, I was riveted by your original book, The Alien and the Scalpel, but you've done an extensive amount of work on the revised second edition. And, folks, I know for a fact that very few of you out there have got anything by Dr. Roger Lear, because I can see how the stuff sells on our website, and it doesn't. It doesn't because you're tuning this out. You're scared of it. You don't want to think about it. But do think about it. It's absolutely fascinating. It's a window into another world. It's one of the most exciting things in terms of scientific pioneering that has ever been done in the history of mankind. So don't tune this out. Get a copy of The Aliens and the Scalpel, the new revised second edition. Even if you've got the first edition, you're going to find a lot of new stuff in here. And since I know that 99.999% of the quarter of a million people who listen to this radio program every week do not have the book, you should get the book. Go to the unknowncountry.com store and actually do it. Get it this time. You've listened to this program for years. You've never bought a thing from the store. This is the one thing you probably ought to get, The Alien and the Scalpel Revised Second Edition. So now this particular little spiel will probably sell about four books, Roger, of the quarter of a million people who should buy it. So,
well, you know, Whitley, your contribution to the first book, you know, was tremendous, and maybe it helped to sell at least the amount that it did sell, which was quite a few copies. But because of the number of pages, we're up to 405 pages with the new one.
Right.
And so some of the stuff the publisher decided to edit out. But there's a lot of new scientific tables in the back of the book. And for those that want to see photos, all the new photos are in the photo section.
You're right.
And also, I didn't want to write this as some kind of a textbook for the scientific mind. I wrote this book so that the average person can pick it up and enjoy it. It's a lot of my, you know, personal life is in there too, and the experiences of the individuals that I talk about. You know, it's a lot more than just a lot of scientific data. So if the folks you know, are afraid of it, like you said, because they think it's just a piece of scientific, boring knowledge.
No, that's not why they're afraid of it. They're afraid of it because it's too scary to think about. They're not bored by it. They're terrified. And that's what I'm trying to get folks over, because we got to look at this. And I'm not saying it's not scary. Of course it's scary. But it's not that scary. So listen, we'll talk about this in just a second. We got to take a break. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. You know, what I've been saying about Dr. Roger Lear could not be more true. People do tune him out because they are afraid to think about this implant issue. However, it is not scary. It's actually incredibly fascinating. When we take these things out, they don't get put back in. So let's learn from this. Let's read Alien and Scalpel. Read The Aliens and the Scalpel. You can get it from the unknowncountry.com store. There is nothing like getting past fear with knowledge. This can be thought about. It can be control. Dr. Roger Lear's pioneering work proves it. Get The Alien and the Scalpel from the unknowncountry.com store right now. You know, William Henry is a very special guy because he's on a quest, and it's a most unusual quest. Now, you can join him in a most unusual way. Recently, he gave an extraordinary lecture, Stargate 2012, Surfing the Tides of the Milky Way. Remarkable lecture at Chet Snow's Signs of Destiny conference. It is loaded with all new 2012 related material. Nobody knows for sure what will happen in 2012, but you can find out some very new ideas from William's latest lecture. Do get it, and do you know you can get it for absolutely nothing? Free. That is correct. Free. Any William Henry purchase you make between now and Christmas on the unknowncountry.com store comes with the lecture DVD absolutely free. And this has been a very successful offer in the past. This lecture is brand new. Don't miss it. get something from the William Henry store, dip into William Henry, and get the lecture absolutely free. If you're not an unknowncountry.com subscriber, you're missing out big time. You would be amazed at what a subscription brings you. Every week, something new that is not in free dreamland. Pushing 100 special interviews from extraordinary things like the amazing Karina Sable's Close Encounter Experience interview. My life reading, where my mother's spirit was contacted by the medium. On and on it goes. Extraordinary information. The unforgettable colloquy between William Henry and Lawrence Gardner about white powder gold. There is so much in there, you cannot believe it. Plus all of my hypnosis sessions, plus all of the key discussions, plus the meditations, plus 6 months of downloadable dreamland, and 6 months of mysterious powers. It's unbeatable. $11.95 gets you started with a 3-month recurring subscription. Click on that subscribe tab right now. Subscribe to unknowncountry.com. We need you, and I can assure you, you need us. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We're talking to Dr. Roger Lear, The Aliens in the Scalp, a revised second edition, an extraordinary dynamite book. It takes you into another world. It opens your mind, and it is not, contrary to what many of you believe, too scary to think about. I think about it all the time, and as I am speaking, I have my finger on the implant in my ear, and I'm living with it. I am not under mind control, and you have to ask a question, well, how would he know if he was under mind control or not? Well, I guess ultimately the answer to that question is a deeply personal one, and I am not. It's as simple as that. Roger, speaking of mind control, conspiracies, and weirdness, I want to talk about Bob Bigelow and John Alexander, who figure in your book somewhat prominently. You have made a long and fruitless journey seeking money to do this research justice. And you came close with these people, and your descriptions of what happened to you at the hands of them, at their hands, is among the most eerie in the book. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your first contacts with John Alexander and Robert Bigelow, and also who they are?
Well, my first contact was actually through my cousin, Dr. Kenneth Ring, who knew both John Alexander and Bob Bigelow and a few other of the scientists with the company. But Bigelow Enterprises, headed by Robert Bigelow, who was a Nevada billionaire and a very sound one at that, decided to put together an organization which he called the National Institute for Discovery Science. And their goal was a twofold goal. One was the science of the mind, which involved near-death experiences, and the other one was having to do with UFOs. So they put together a science advisory board of some of the top scientists in the United States. Well, I didn't know these people from Adam. So my contact, as I said, was through my cousin, and the first person I talked to was John Alexander, and he said, what do you got, and what are you doing, and so on. Then after a phone conversation, he said, can you fax me some of the material? I did. And lo and behold, almost, I think it was only about 2 days went by, I got a call at some ungodly hour of the morning, very, very early. And it was John on the line, and he said, are you up for a conference call? And I said, well, certainly. And he had Bob Bigelow on the line personally. And they both started to ask me questions and so on. And next thing I knew, I got an invitation to go to Nevada and meet with them. And we had a preliminary meeting, and he kind of liked me, I think. Then he decided that it might be possible for them to enter in the research and support it with the funds that they had. And I was all for that. Then a second meeting occurred, and we actually brought some of the implant specimens that we had, the early ones. And I made a presentation before the Science Advisory Board of MIDS, and that was really one of the most scary things I have ever done in my life. I don't put myself in any way in the category of those individuals. These are multiple PhDs and specialties of science, and for me to show them anything was kind of scary. But I just told them what we had, and most of the data we had at that time was biological data. We hadn't really done anything on the bubble at all. And during the course of the presentation, about half of the members of the board took up on my stead, and when questions were asked of me that I couldn't answer, they just piped in. And answered them for me. So at least at that time, I knew I'd conquered at least half of the board. Then at the end of the meeting, we were asked to leave until a decision was made, waited downstairs in the dining room area with about all the food you could eat.
Right.
And Bob Bigelow would pop down every once in a while telling us what was going on and the progress of the meeting. And finally, he came down and said, yes, we're going to do it. Let's take a stroll through the garden. And we did. And on a handshake deal, they supported the metallurgical research for the first number of implants, and they supported the money to do three of the following surgeries. And they also put up the funds to write the book. So I can't really
say anything. So they did help you.
Absolutely. Yes, I can't say anything sinister about these people.
Okay, well,
I know the rumors.
I misunderstood then. I'm sorry. And I'm glad in a way because I know John Alexander and like him very much. He is the center of so much conspiracy theory, though. What's your opinion of that? I mean, people consider him to be an active intelligence agent, and they consider the Bigelow Organization, the now-defunct NIDS, National Institute for Discovery Sciences, was something that absorbed information without ever giving anything out, and that it was an intelligence operation from the beginning. Does any of that strike you as being possibly true or in the direction
of
true?
Absolutely not. The people who say that are suspicious and small-minded and don't really understand. You see, the thing that's an affront to ufology research, quote-unquote, is that NIDS only did things in a very scientific way. And as I described the board, this is composed of a board of national scientists, which are extremely famous. And they deal in science. They don't deal in anecdotal data. And what you don't do, which is done in the field of ufology, is if somebody finds something and right away they run to a broadcast of some program and blab about it before it's ever been tested. That's not science. So if you are doing scientific research and you don't come up with any kind of an answer, you know, why talk about it? It's just not worth talking about it. You know, we went through a long thing with the DNA from the Gary Lowry case, and we had almost published an article in the scientific stating that we had non-terrestrial DNA. And just at the last minute, continuing to follow genetics and the role of science, what we found was that we had a slug. You know, and you could think of the embarrassment that would have occurred if myself, NIDS, and any of the NIDS board had gone through and published that article.
Right.
Just stayed right at the last minute. So those folks that are critics of NIDS, John Alexander, just don't accept scientific things. Now, John is what he is. You know, he's in the CIA, and I think when you're in the CIA, you don't exactly completely retire.
Well, I don't think he was actually in the CIA. I think he was in military intelligence, and he was the director of the non-lethal weapons program, which is was he also in the CIA?
Yeah, I believe so. He is known as the father of this nation's non-lethal weapons program.
Right, and
as you can see, as a consultant status, I'm sure that he was with the CIA because he was involved with the CIA remote viewing and telekinesis program.
Well, that's true. I I got to know him a little bit when he was in San Antonio, Texas, working on the non-lethal weapons program with Bill Mallow, who was the person developing that friction-free substance that they were supposed to be able to spray on roads and so forth that would render the surface unable to be crossed by a vehicle or anyone on foot or anything like that. And so he was there, and we met and spent a good bit of time together. And frankly, I have to be honest with you, had a lot of fun. But of course, it's the job of somebody like that to be charming to a person that might have be able to spill secrets of some sort, like me. Although I'm not aware of any that I haven't already spilled. Certainly, I am the worst keeper of secrets in the world. I blab away about everything that happens to me, and certainly in my close encounter experience, I've held nothing back that I know of. So, but let's go on now. What I want to do when we get into the last part of the program, something that nobody ever really asks you, and I'm always dying to ask you, and I hear you on the air, is what do you think, and I know partly how your answer is going to be, and I'm going to get into it a little more deeply this time, what these things are for, and just how many people might have them, might not you have one in your body, and what does that mean to you, my friend, if you have had the courage to continue listening to Dr. Roger Lear and entertaining all of the possibilities that surround implantation. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. We'll be right back. You know, what I've been saying about Dr. Roger Lear could not be more true. People do tune him out because they are afraid to think about this implant issue. However, it is not scary. It's actually incredibly fascinating. When we take these things out, they don't get put back in. So let's learn from this. Let's read Alien and Scalpel. Read the Aliens and the Scalpel. You can get it from the UnknownCountry.com store. There is nothing like getting past fear with knowledge. This can be thought about. It can be control. Dr. Roger Lear's pioneering work proves it. Get the Alien and the Scalpel from the UnknownCountry.com store right now. If you're not an UnknownCountry.com subscriber, you're missing out big time. You would be amazed at what a subscription brings you. Every week, something new that is not in free dreamland. Pushing 100 special interviews from extraordinary things like the amazing Karina Sable's Close Encounter Experience interview. My life reading, where my mother's spirit was contacted by the medium. On and on it goes. Extraordinary information. The unforgettable colloquy between William Henry and Lawrence Gardner about white powder gold. There is so much in there, you cannot believe it. Plus all of my hypnosis sessions, plus all of the key discussions, plus the meditations, plus 6 months of downloadable Dreamland and 6 months of mysterious powers. It's unbeatable. $11.95 gets you started with a 3-month recurring subscription. Click on that subscribe tab right now. Subscribe to UnknownCountry.com. We need you, and I can assure you, you need us. You know, William Henry is a very special guy because he's on a quest, and it's a most unusual quest. Now, you can join him in a most unusual way. Recently, he gave an extraordinary lecture, Stargate 2012, Surfing the Tides of the Milky Way. Remarkable lecture at Chet Snow's Signs of Destiny conference. It is loaded with all new 2012 related material. Nobody knows for sure what will happen in 2012, but you can find out some very new ideas from William's latest lecture. Do get it, and do you know you can get it for absolutely nothing? Free. That is correct. Free. Any William Henry purchase you make between now and Christmas on the UnknownCountry.com store comes with the lecture DVD absolutely free. And this has been a very successful offer in the past. This lecture is brand new. Don't miss it. Get something from the William Henry store. Dip into William Henry and get the lecture absolutely free. This is Whitley Strieber. It's Dreamland. Implants, the most provocative frontier of UFO research. Dr. Roger Lear, the pioneer, he has personally extracted these things from many people's bodies. They have been extensively studied scientifically. They're not explainable by any conventional means. His book, The Aliens and the Scalpel, the wonderful revised second edition, gets into this really deeply. It reads like a thriller because it is a thriller. It's an extraordinary thriller written by a real pioneer, a man of genuine courage, very, very rare in this world. Dr. Roger Lear, now let me ask you what I was getting ready to ask you before the break that is a burning question with most of us. What do you think these things could be for? And I know that you can't say, tell us, well, I know what the aliens are doing or what whoever's doing it is doing. But what do you think, in your considered opinion, might be going on?
Well, you know, treating this subject on a scientific level, guesses aren't any good, but you are allowed to put out some theories, and of course the theories then have to be taken into a laboratory and either proved or disproved. That's the way science works. So, yes, I do have a theory, and it's kind of a complex one because it involves the whole subject of abduction. And in the last few years, I've traveled extensively around the world to over 40 different countries, and I've talked with abduction victims, if you want to use that word, those that don't speak English through an interpreter, and the phenomena is relatively the same. The common denominator, and I'm sure Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs will not disagree with this, the common denominator in most cases seems to be the taking of ova and sperm, for what purpose we can only guess and do not know. Now, if something is going on like this, there's something, it seems to me, you can at least say there's something to do genetic-wise with the human race. Now, let's break off right there and go to something else that I found. I have a young daughter, 13 years old, who is quite exceptional and a lot different than my older children. And she started to absolutely amaze me by the things she would say. It was like she could reach into some universal pool of knowledge and come out with these plums. So I started talking to abductees about their children and so on, and I found that this was rather common. In fact, I never had anyone disagree with me, parent, grandparent, or whatever. And so I said, you know, maybe there's something going on with the children of today. So I said, well, you know, I'm in medical science, so let me take a look at something we can look at, some data, some statistics. So I took a look at growth characteristics of children, and I took things, you know, not that were variable like IQs and things like that, but what age does a child raise a head? What age do they smile? What age can they stand up? What age can they talk? And so on. And so I looked at statistics going back to 1947. And I didn't pick 1947 because of Roswell, but I picked 1947 because the statistics were not updated between 1947 and 1987. So it was a perfect period of time where I could compare these worldwide statistics. So I took a look at them, and I wrote them down, and I found 17 of these growth characteristics which were measured and comparable. Now, not everything they measured in 1947 was measured in 1987. And the things they measured from 1987 on were not measured in 1947. Example, the age of patty cake. And you say, well, my goodness, why would anyone want to measure the age of patty cake? Well, if we remember in astronaut training, the astronauts are put into a chamber, and then the atmospheric pressure is gradually reduced. And what are they doing in the chamber? They're playing patty cake. And this requires a distinct amount of eye-hand muscle coordination. And as you reduce the atmospheric pressure, this coordination begins to disappear. So it's a measurable thing. Well, they didn't measure that in 1947, but they measured 17 others. And I looked at these 17 others, and they, in a 40-year period, were accelerated between 16 and 80%. Now, that's a big acceleration for 40 years. Now, I'm getting to the point where I'm going to answer your question. What is the reason for this? You know, if we accept this as a worldwide phenomenon, what is the reason? Could it, nothing but evolution? You know, plain simple evolution. Well, I think not. Not in 40 years to have that much change. Could it be what we call now fast evolution? No. We're getting it down now to like 100 years. This is 40 years.
Right.
So I don't think it's evolution. So let's look at the next big one. The big one is environment.
Right.
Now, is it the degradation of the ozone layer? Is it what they eat? Is it television? Is it whale blubber? Is it alcohol? Well, you can't say that it's that because it's common all over the world, and we're looking at varying environments. So if the statistics are holding true, then it seems like there's nothing in the environment that's going to do this. So I pretty much eliminated environment. The next thing I looked at was mutation. Could it be a mutation? High-energy particles, hitting genes and so on. But if you look at mutations are what we call random mutations. You may find a baby born with an extra finger or a blue eye and a brown eye. But these are real, full-time, coordinated things that are going on. These are not mutations. So if you eliminate those three, there's only really two things you can be left with. Now, if you're a devout theist, then the answer is simple. It's an act of God. So be happy, smile, look in the mirror, and say, okay, it's an act of God. Can't argue with that. And if you don't accept that as 100% truth, then you're only left with one other possibility. And that is the human race is being genetically manipulated. And if this manipulation is going on over a period of years on a worldwide basis, one of the ways to check the progress is to put something in these individuals that can give you remotely some indication of the success of the genetic engineering. And
whatever you may be doing.
Right. And that, my friend, is my theory for what these implants are.
Well, to be honest with you, and with you also, listeners, the thing in my head, in my ear, seems to be usable. It seems to be a tool, and I think it might be quite an extraordinary tool. I have begun to find that there is information that comes into my mind if I want it there that seems to be related to it. Now, let me ask you, Roger, do people report, seeing anybody, or do they remember the implantation process? I know all of them don't, but do some of them? And if so, how do they describe it? Is it consistent?
Some of them do. Some of them actually remember being on a ship and having something inserted. They remember the whole procedure, either consciously or with hypnosis assistance.
Right.
One individual was 6 years old. Living in a very poor potato farming area of Texas. He woke up in the wee hours of the morning. He saw a bright light fill the room. He heard a voice that told him to get up out of the bed, walk out of the house, walk around to a freshly plowed furrow, come around to a specific area, and then he followed the directions, walk forward. He claims that he was looking at a tree, and he saw these balls of light hanging around the tree. And then one of the balls of light came toward him, and he was told to reach out and grab it. Instead of doing so, however, he became panicky, turned and started to run, and evidently hit one of the balls of light with his hand, and something happened. He didn't know what. The next thing he knew, he was back in bed. He woke up that morning, and there was blood all over the sheet. And there was no scar. There was no injury to the hand. Nothing. All he had was this crazy story and blood all over were the best. This was the individual who had a metallic object in his hand.
Now, I remember what happened to me very well. I woke up. It happened in a May evening, I believe, in 1989. And I woke up. It was the windows were open in the house. We're in the country, and I heard as I woke up, I heard a male voice say in the backyard very clearly, "Condition red." I looked and saw a woman and a man, a bearded man, standing in the hallway. That it was across the room from the foot of our bed. These two individuals came forward. There was something there as well that was kind of gliding that I didn't see clearly, but it seemed to be that there was something accompanying them. I wouldn't say it was a living creature. I just don't know what it was. And the next thing I knew, I was lying on my side. I felt my eyes were open. It was dark. I could not see. And something was being there was pressure against my ear, against the side of my head, and the woman was speaking to me in a not unpleasant and fairly gentle sort of a way. The next thing I knew, there was a flash of light and a glow around the house, bright from above, and the sound of people crashing off into the woods in the night, running wildly, it sounded like, through the underbrush. And so I remember what happened to me, and I always ask if people think that these are alien implants, because I have to tell you that if there was an alien present when I was implanted, it was very hard to detect. It looked like people did it. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's been proven that whatever you call these aliens, visitors, travelers, or whatever they may be, have the ability to cloud the actual events that happen, and conscious memories are sometimes fragmented, and you remember things in a certain way. This just like the case that I mentioned, where the child remembers being hit in the back of the hand for hitting this exploding ball. I don't think that's what happened at all. What you remember are probably put together fragments of a situation in which you're, seeing something other than typical gray beings. But they want you to see or remember whatever it is that they decide that they're going to leave that thought with.
Okay, we've come to the end of our time together, Roger. In a way, it's unfortunate. We need to do this again because I have a feeling that somewhere between the two of us, we know things about this that we're not yet saying, or that we could speculate about. As I said before, I don't feel as if I'm under any form of mind control. On the contrary, I think that the object in my ear is a mind opener, not a mind closer, and that I'm just beginning to be able to make use of it. And I think when people read the book I'm working on, The Grays, they'll see that, indeed, my mind has been opened to some of the deepest secrets of this whole mystery, and I think that that object has got something to do with it. Okay, enough said. The Alien and the Scalpel, the revised, new, expanded edition. Do you want to revise your mind and not get implanted in the process? Well, one way to do it is to read this extraordinary book from Dr. Roger Lear, a true pioneer. Thank you so much for being with us, Roger Lear. Next up on Dreamland, Linda Moulton Howe. You want your hair curled? Well, this time she's got the hair curler for you. This is going to really surprise you. We'll be right back.
Here is Professor Lonnie Thompson.
Our interest in this 5,200-year event actually started in 2002 when we discovered these plants coming out from the retreating margin of the Quelccaya ice cap. The ice cliff there is about 30 meters high, and right at the base there was this plant deposit, and it's about 2 meters across and These are wetland plants. They're not woody tissue. They're and that's what makes them remarkable because they were so well preserved. And in collecting those plants and then having them identified, the Sitchia muscoides is the main type of plant in that collection. Then having it dated in two different labs, came back 5,200 years old. And from that we started to first of all, for that site, it tells us a lot of things. Number one is would be that sometime before 5,200 years ago, it had to be at least as warm as today for this plant to have grown at this site. And also, whatever happened had to be extremely abrupt because the plant was captured. It's so well preserved that they've actually been able to do DNA on the tissues from the plant. So it would say that, you know, the climate system, the natural climate system back then was capable of very abrupt change. The probably most disturbing here is that, we returned to this tropical ice cap this past summer, and we collected plants in adjacent valley, and we found three collections, and two of those collections came in at 5,000 years before present, which is consistent with our earlier collection. But the third one is really disturbing because it comes in at over 55,000 years old, this plant. And again, it's a wetland plant. Cell structure is perfectly preserved. But it means that that plant has, I think the most straightforward interpretation there is that this plant has not been exposed for over 50,000 years, and which would say what is happening there today is unusual on the time scale of 50,000 years.
That all of the cooling effects and ice that caused dramatic changes in the past is now melting so rapidly that we're being able to see plants that range from 5,000 to 50,000 years old that have been buried under ice.
That's correct. And I think this is happening all over the world, and we can actually, by collecting these plants and animals and humans coming out of the ice, we can actually put dates on when was the last time that these glaciers were as small as they are today. And that kind of puts this change that's taking place in the 21st century into a perspective.
When you say abrupt change, as is seen in these plants, are we talking about something that happened in 24 hours, 48 hours?
I think we're talking about something that happened in the order of, days to weeks. Because the plant, in order to be so well preserved, had to be captured, and whatever the event was, there had to be enough snow fall in this area to bury it deep enough so that it was not exposed again until just a few years ago. Otherwise, this plant would have decayed. And likewise, we have looked around the world at other records, and one of the most interesting of these is the Ötzi, the Iceman, who came out of the glaciers in the Austrian Alps back in 1991. And if you read the story on Ötzi, he was shot in the back with an arrow, and he escaped his captives, and he sat down on this, behind this boulder at the top of the Austrian Alps, and he bled to death. But shortly after he died, there had to be a snow event that was large enough to bury him deep enough so that for 5,200 years, which is his age, he was covered by ice, only coming out in the recent decade. And then if you look around the world, we've drilled the ice fields of Kilimanjaro in Africa, and the lowest, most negative isotope event, and an isotope's indication of temperature and precipitation, occurs 5,200 years ago in Africa. Then if you go into the south, the Middle East, into Israel, there are speleothem records there, where there are isotope records from these speleothems show that there's just one event in the last 13,000 years, a very wet event, 5,200 years ago. And those are uranium-thorium dated. Then if you go to England and Ireland, there are trees, oak tree chronologies, that are annual. They go back 7,000 years. And the narrowest ring in that collection is 5,000 194 years before present. And then if you come to North America, when I was at American Geophysical Union, I was giving the Emiliani lecture. Now, Emiliani was an oceanographer, but he did a study that was published in Science back in 1979 on a spring, a water hole down in Florida. And it turns out that this spring is actually a sinkhole. It's a cavern. And in the early history in Florida, humans and animals would go to this spring in times of drought to get water. And it turned out that there are ledges in this sinkhole where people actually lived. And he had dated the last time this spring, there was a sudden rise in water in this spring, based on human bones and artifacts. And this was 5,220 years ago.
And that if the sun could have triggered such a massive and rapid change 5,200 years ago, that we could trigger exactly the same kind of rapid change now.
I believe this is the case. I mean, we study ice here, and ice is a threshold system. You know, ice is perfectly happy until you reach 32 degrees Fahrenheit. At 32 degrees Fahrenheit, it crosses the threshold. It melts. It becomes water. And I think that the natural systems of this planet, many of them operate on thresholds. And you're okay, you can change something up to a certain limit, but if you cross that threshold, then the system reorganizes. And it's something completely different than what was before. And in the case of climate, that would be in the form of an abrupt climate change. If we look at the warmest year on record since we've kept temperature records was 1998. The second warmest year on record was 2002. The third was 2003. And 2004 is going to come in as the fourth warmest year since we've been keeping records. But over the last 20 years, the solar output, the energy output of the sun, has actually decreased. So we got other players at work here, and the most likely candidate is the increase in greenhouse gases. If you look at these greenhouse gas variations, they're kind of a natural, you could call it the breathing of the planet through time, and there's seems to be an upper level and a lower level. The upper level is about 280. Of course, humans came along, and with our technology, we've been able to mine the forest of the past through the oil and the gas and the coal that we're consuming, bring all that carbon that had been taken out of the atmosphere by geologic processes, and we released it into the atmosphere. And so about 1900, we passed 300 parts per million by volume. This year, we're up to about 380 parts per million by volume. And that's increasing at a higher rate, especially in the last 2 years, which we're not sure why, but it's increasing over 2 parts per million by volume each year. And it gets back to this this concept of thresholds, that the climate system works on thresholds, and whatever caused that abrupt change 5,200 years ago, you know, what if there's a threshold for carbon dioxide? We pass, 400 or 500 parts per million by volume, and we see an abrupt change in the climate system, not a gradual change, and you can say, well, what is the worst case scenario for a warming Earth? If you raise temperatures to the point where you removed all the mountain glaciers on Earth, and we're doing that, I mean, they're all retreating, you could raise sea level by a half a meter. Then you could look around the world and see what the impact of a half a meter rise in sea level would be, and that would be to displace over 100 million people. And then you say, well, what if we remove Greenland ice cap? If we did that, we would raise sea level by 7.5 meters. And then you would displace millions and millions of people. And in the worst-case scenario, if you removed the Antarctic ice sheet, you would raise sea level another 65 meters. And our world would be totally different than what it is today. So, you can always look at the worst-case scenario. Now, I think that the evidence would suggest that these changes in sea level are occurring, and initially we're going to be dealing with displacements of millions of people. And I think this is likely to take place simply because we as human beings haven't got our act together in that we are doing nothing to curtail emissions of CO2. And if you look at the economies developing around the world, like China, we got a lot of economies coming online that are going to be big consumers of fossil fuels and hence producers of CO2. So I think that we are going to be dealing with an adaptation to a changing climate system as well as increasing sea levels.
But for the plant in the Colcaya ice cap in Peru and for the hiker in the Alpine Glacier to have been trapped and preserved, doesn't that mean that there would have been a sudden drop in temperature and there would have had to have been a lot of snow suddenly?
Yes, absolutely. At the higher elevations where the temperatures are cold enough, there had to be lots of snow. And I think at other areas, lower elevations, like if you go in the Middle East, you look at the stalactite measurement, that shows it was wet. And it's interesting, if you go to the Natural History Museum in London, there are tablets there that come from Iraq and from Syria that date back 5,000 years ago that talk about huge floods in that part of the world. So if you're low enough and the temperature's warm enough, of course it's going to be rain. But if you're up higher elevations or high latitudes, then you could have very heavy snowfall. And obviously that's what captured the plant, that's what captured ITSE.
Well then, what you're suggesting is that there would have been a tremendous amount of moisture all around the planet 5,200 years ago.
There would have been a displacement. Prior to 5,200 years ago, the Sahara Desert was a wet place. There were lakes. There were actually people living out there. But 5,200 years ago, it suddenly dried up. And I mean, it was a very fast event. And so moisture that was falling in that area is being displaced to other areas, perhaps in the Middle East, where they had these record rainfalls. So what you find is that there's a disruption of the moisture system. Places that were dry become wet. Places that were wet become dry.
Is the difference now that it is warming rapidly, and 5,200 years ago it was suddenly much colder?
Well, I think if you look at the carbon 14 production, you see it going in both directions, up and down.
5,200 years ago.
Yes, and so. You probably had a large disturbance in the climate system that manifested itself in all these different records at the time. When we look at today's climate and the forcings that we have, we look at the greenhouse gases. We're looking at a period of time in which the mean temperatures of the planet are rising. That means that as the mean rise, the chances of having extremes going in both directions, both warmer and colder, increase. And if we had in 2003 the heat waves in Europe, those were an extreme in the weather patterns. Those become more common as the mean temperatures rise on the planet. So,
well, if sudden ice conditions and sudden desert conditions are what happened 5,200 years ago, a catastrophe then, what do you think is the catastrophe now? Will it be increases in the hurricanes and strengths of storms?
My personal view on this is that what we people will respond to will be economics, the cost of these changes. You can look at the hurricanes in Florida this year, the cost of that. Huge, billions and billions of dollars. The cost to the oil industry, to their oil platforms out in the Gulf of Mexico, the cost to the reinsurance agencies. And to me, unfortunately, our economic structure for the planet, and again, it doesn't matter whether you're in the U.S. or in China or whatever, people react to changes in dollars and cents, and particularly in things that cost. And I think we're already seeing evidence of the cost of the system changing.
that it's increasing in terms of catastrophes and destruction by weather events.
Exactly.
And why is this government not leading that search for solutions on the carbon dioxide buildup?
Well, that's unfortunate, because my feeling is that as the number one producer of CO2 emissions on Earth, we need to be at the table. You may not like whatever policy is on the table at the time, but we need to be a player working toward finding a solution that works for everyone. And my feeling is it doesn't really matter what our government thinks, or people think, for that matter. It's the system will react, and it will change, and we will adapt, because we'll have no choice.
And if we keep having hurricane seasons increasing, whether it's a natural cycle on the Earth or it's because global warming is contributing to the energy of storms, the amount of money that it will continue to take year after year dealing with floods, hurricanes, and those kinds of crises will have to exceed the cost of trying to reduce CO2, wouldn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Many companies that actually have worked on CO2 reductions, such as British Petroleum, I have found that didn't cost them anything. By fixing the leaks in your pipelines, you reduce methane going into the Earth's atmosphere, but you also increase the amount of fuel that you're getting to your user, where you probably want to make a difference.
So why shouldn't the United States follow those leads and be pushing for reduction in CO2?
Well, I think again, it comes back to the economic perceptions that we have now. The people in power believe that any of these type of moves in this direction will cost money and will impact the economy of this country. And I think that the only way this ultimately we change that is it has to be done in a way that it is in the economic interest of these people to make these changes, which I absolutely believe is the case.
Or that the catastrophes in climate around the world, from heat and drought and floods and hurricanes, continue to increase to the point that people begin screaming for governments to act?
Well, it becomes increasingly difficult for them to act at that point, because so much of the resources are then going to dealing with the immediate human problem of displacement, the reconstruction of houses and everything. It would be a prudent government, in my opinion, would be looking to the future, taking a long-term view that we can do a little at a relatively low cost now, which will have a tremendous impact 10 or 20 years down the line in the way of renewable energy sources. It's not just the U.S., it's a problem in China. I mean, one of the reasons that the U.S. has objected to Kyoto Protocol was that China and India aren't part of that. And that's a good objection. They need to be part of it, because within 10 or 20 years, China will probably be the biggest CO2 producer. And the point is that this problem can only be solved by people working together. And we haven't taken the first step here yet.
Well, as a scientist and as a person living on the Earth, do you think right now it is pretty inevitable that in this century we're going to face climate challenges, weather challenges, like we've never faced before?
Would be my opinion. I think this is going to be our number one problem of the 21st century.
And it makes you wonder, Whitley, why is it that we are cutting off our nose despite our face in this country when it comes to some rigorous policies of trying to get some incentive under solar, wind, hydrogen, and alternatives to fossil fuels that truly are causing a problem for the foreseeable future?
We are cutting off our noses despite our face, Linda, and the casualty insurance industry, as Dr. Thompson points out, in 2005 will in part collapse because of the combination of the typhoons that struck Asia, primarily Japan and Taiwan last year, the four hurricanes that struck Florida, and now the tsunamis, because bear in mind that, for example, the Phuket, the travel industry in Phuket is heavily insured by Chinese insurance companies, in fact, or by Hong Kong underwriters and Thai insurance companies. And there's going to this industry is going to take a tremendous hit. I regard people such as Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and George W. Bush, his father as well, as Rush Limbaugh, as being personally responsible, in Clinton's case, for allowing the American people to remain complacent about this in the interest of satisfying his popularity ratings. In the case of the others, of willfully ignoring scientific evidence in favor of corporate sponsors who are themselves not particularly concerned about global warming, primarily the oil companies. But there are lots of other industries that are concerned about these changes, and the casualty insurance industry leads the pack.
Mm-hmm. And my sense with talking with Professor Thompson is that the scientists are extremely frustrated that they're not seeing more leadership on the part of this government. But, as he pointed out, it is so difficult if there is an oil power lobby that is resisting putting a lot of money, energy, and effort right now into hydrogen, into solar, and into other alternatives because they want to get every dollar out of every last drop of oil. And in the process, we could be hurt so much more financially in the future. We should be doing work now to change things, not waiting for absolute catastrophe.
Well, we are waiting for absolute catastrophe, and Dr. Thompson's work shows that it has happened in the past, and boy, is it ever absolute. It's too bad that the Iceman cannot warn us, because bear in mind what Dr. Thompson was talking about. This man was hiking through a verdant alpine meadow when he was overtaken by a snowstorm, which caused him eventually to freeze to death, and he remained frozen there for 5,000 years under that ice. Now, what does that tell you about the speed with which this came on? And then, at the same time in Peru, the worldwide impact and power of this catastrophe must have been overwhelming, and that's without us adding to the global warming picture.
That's why Professor Thompson is so concerned about what's happening now, because if the Earth's climate could change within days in 5,200 years ago in natural changes from the sun's variation, that's his hypothesis. What in the world could happen now with us possibly reaching a threshold with carbon dioxide that could trigger a change as abrupt with consequences that none of us yet know?
Well, Linda, unfortunately, we will see that change, I would think, and the responsible parties will all start out by saying, not my fault, and whatever is left of the media will be trumpeting that message to an innocent and hoodwinked public. Thank you very much, Linda Moldenhau, for a powerful and provocative report. 5,200 years ago, it happened, just like in Superstorm. Wait for it. This has been Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. Thanks very much for listening. We'll be back next week with another journey to the extreme edge of controversy on Dreamland. Do not miss it.